From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Reflecting on her more than 20 years as an Episcopal priest, Barbara Brown Taylor says that one of the things that almost killed her was becoming a professional holy person. She left active ministry after serving as the first woman rector in a small parish in Georgia. She says that as hard as it was to get to the point where she could wear a clerical collar, taking it off turned out to be as necessary to her salvation as putting it on. We'll talk with her about her memoir, Leaving Church. And our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers a word that has just been redefined, planet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Barbara Brown Taylor, is an Episcopal priest in a world in which she says religion often seems to do more harm than good. She was ordained in 1983, then spent several years as an associate in a large urban church in Atlanta. In the 10th year of her priesthood, she found what she thought she was looking for, a small parish in North Georgia that was looking for a new rector. She moved there with her husband in 1992. Although she expected that at this point in her life she would be a seasoned parish minister wearing black clergy shirts grown gray from frequent washing, she now makes her living teaching religion at Piedmont College, not leading worship. She explains why in her book, Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. Barbara Brown Taylor, welcome to Fresh Air. I guess I'm most interested in why you gave up your work as a priest, but before we get there, let's start with what it was like to be a woman priest in an Episcopal church in a small town in Georgia. And as you write in your book, the Episcopal Church had been ordaining women for almost 16 years when you became the Reverend at Grace Calvary Church, but you were the first woman priest in the whole county. And you say that many local churches still taught that Scripture forbade women to speak in church. So what are some of the things you faced as a woman priest in the church?
Well, I faced, first of all, a lot of excitement about filling that role in this small town I had already fallen in love with, and that they would invite me to be part of them was a great, great happiness to me. I suppose the first vivid memory was being invited to the County Ministerial Association, where I was the only woman present among 25 or 30 men who met at the Western Sizzlin' restaurant. And they had invited me to speak on Episcopal beliefs, so I thought I would break the ice by looking out at them and saying, I know you invited me to speak on Episcopal beliefs because you don't think we have any, and no one laughed. So it was not a great start, but they were very polite. They never knew what to do with me, but no one was ever less than kind.
Did you feel like you were a big departure from what they were used to?
I was such a departure from what they were used to that there were a great many fears before I showed up, I think, about what I would look like, how I would dress, what kind of car I would drive. I think people were afraid I'd show up with 2-inch red fingernails and wear bright lipstick and open-toed sandals at the communion rail or something like that. But I'm fairly ordinary, so most of those fears were unmet. But other people simply did not know how to address a woman priest. Some people thought the clerical collar meant I was a Catholic nun. And then when I hired a male associate later, many, many people at that point told me they were sorry I was leaving, and I asked them what they were talking about. They said, well, we met the new minister, and he's wonderful. He looked like everything, I suppose, I should have looked like.
Well, let's get to a couple of questions that the people had, like how do you address a woman priest? Well, obviously, they can't call you father, and sister is the word for a nun. So what is the right way to call you in church?
Well, I have been called Father Taylor. I've received letters to Father Taylor, and there are areas of the Episcopal Church where I would be called Mother Taylor, but that has always struck me as sort of a mix-up of roles. So the churches I've served have always decided that the names we were baptized with are the names to address one another by. So I've always been on a first-name basis in parishes I've served.
And how did you dress when you were a priest in church?
I think because I came into the church in a high Anglican church in New Haven, Connecticut, where priesthood was very vested, lots of brocade on Sundays and black suits the rest of the week. So I immediately bought a lot of black suits, and all of my clergy shirts were long-sleeve black clergy shirts. I really welcomed the uniform in the beginning. So that's how I dressed, lots of gray, lots of black, and lots of gray and black stripes.
And a collar.
And a white collar.
And did you feel transformed when you'd put on the white collar?
I felt very visible when I put on the white collar. I know that I responded to collars in the world as people who clearly had nothing to do but to give me directions or help me find my way. And people responded to me in much the same way. I found that the collar opened doors not only to hospital rooms, but to conversations on buses and in subway stations and all over the place.
Now, you write in your memoir that the thing that almost killed you was becoming a professional holy person. What do you mean?
That's true. Well, what I mean is, as eager as I was to move in with God on a full-time basis, and as eager as I was to do that in the only way I knew how, which was to become an ordained person, to work full-time, beyond full-time, in the church, it soon dawned on me that that meant I received a salary for loving people, that I received everything from dental insurance to long-term disability that was associated with my job of loving people. And I had lost the pleasure of an amateur, which is to love for free, to do what I did simply for the love of it. So I do think there are ways in which, both through my own fault and in some ways the lures of the institution, becoming a professional holy person set up some walls between me and God and me and other people that ended up not being good for my soul.
Did people have certain expectations of you in terms of your closeness with God and your ability to really understand God that you felt you couldn't fulfill?
Oh, all the time, every day. I would wake up every morning and thank God for being alive and then be curious about whom I would disappoint that day. There had to be someone. Sometimes it was only myself I disappointed, but I did, of course, find people had reasonable expectations, which included the fact that I'd gone to seminary. I'd spent 3 years in higher education in a graduate school of theology. So people expected me to know scripture and theology and history and ancient languages. But people also expected that inspiration would rise up for me out of my pillow at night, that I could preach fabulous sermons on Sunday with absolutely no time to work on them, that I would have some kind of direct line to God with answers to questions that have been insoluble forever. And again, it's always hard to separate those expectations from my own, but I did feel sometimes either like the Virgin Mary's younger sister or like some mediator, confidant of God's who had the secret answers. And of course, I didn't.
By the Virgin Mary's younger sister, you mean somebody who who needed to be kind of protected from worldly things and from any sexual reference?
Yes, I spent a lot of time in this book thinking about that funny paradox. On the one hand, people who treated me really with just the loveliest reverence, the kindest politeness, who hid beers behind their backs when I walked into rooms, who immediately changed the subject to Sunday school whenever they saw me coming, and again treated me as a very proper lady. And then on the other hand, many of these same people would call at midnight to tell me that I was their one phone call from jail and that they needed to be bailed out. I would hear from people who'd been admitted to treatment facilities for addiction. I would hear from these same people when a husband or wife collapsed in the bathroom or had been taken to the emergency room. So at the same time, I was treated with great deference in public. In private, I think I saw just about every part of the human condition there was to see.
What did it say to you that people treated you in both ways, in two such extreme ways, getting exposed to the people in your parish's worst problems, but them also trying to be very protective of you?
I wonder sometimes if it's not the same way in which people approach the Holy One, i.e. God. I think of ways in which people work very hard to compose perfect prayers, reverent prayers, polite prayers, and then within minutes are in tears, confessing the messy, broken, despairing parts of themselves as well. So I'm not sure that I didn't just get a piece of the pie that God is served on a daily basis.
My guest is Barbara Brown Taylor. Her new memoir is called Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barbara Brown Taylor. She's an Episcopal priest who left active ministry after nearly 15 years at the pulpit. She now teaches religion at Piedmont College. Her new memoir is called Leaving Church. You say that at some point you got compassion fatigue. What do you think brought it on, and how did you know that was what you were experiencing?
That's a wonderful question. I first of all would say I know that compassion fatigue is not at all particular to ordained ministry. I know physicians, emergency room nurses. I don't know any dentists with compassion fatigue, but I'm sure that some of them have it. I think that anyone who is in the business of emotional labor, that is, whose job includes feeling certain ways and even perhaps producing certain feelings in other people, are sitting ducks for compassion fatigue. How I knew I was suffering from it is an even deeper question, because I'm fairly stoic. I'm an eldest child. I sometimes say I was raised as my father's oldest son, because I learned to shoot guns and ride horses before I ever played with a Barbie doll. But because I'm pretty stoic, I did not know how tired I was, really, until I resigned from parish ministry. And then for about 3 months following that, felt as if I were recuperating from a debilitating illness. It was as if my heart had gone to sleep under a heavy, heavy load, and I didn't know how asleep it was until it began to wake up.
And you felt it woke up after you resigned?
It did. My heart, of course, had to be very alive in parish ministry. You don't survive long without a working heart in that job. But I guess one way I would talk about it is there is in my life a great deal of public truth. I've been in the business of public truth for 20 years. That is, saying the truth from the pulpit in the Sunday school classroom in various articles. Public truth, the truth I believe is good for everyone, perhaps true for everyone, but whole milk truth. And in this present book, I have explored private truth, truth that for many years I boxed up and took down to the basement until there finally wasn't room for any more boxes. And I realized some of my best stuff was down there. So the compassion fatigue perhaps came from being such a careful censor of truth, of what was appropriate and what was not, of what seemed holy and what did not. And the great relief following the giving up of that was to keep my truth all in one place and to feel the liberation of that, the salvation, if you will, deep down in my bones.
Now, in the Episcopal tradition, priests can marry. And right. You were married while you were in the ministry.
Yes.
Do you think your experience as a woman priest, a married woman priest, was very different than the experience of male priests? And do you think people treated you differently because you were a wife as well as a priest?
I think so. Early on, one of the rumors when I came to Grace Calvary Church, that was that somehow my husband had finessed my hiring. It was the oddest, oddest rumor in the world, as if he could go get me a job or buy me a church or just fix me up any way I wanted to be fixed up. There's statistics in the Episcopal Church that have sort of a rank of wellness, and I guess the people who are happiest among clergy and spouses are the husbands of women priests. They rank high on the wellness scale. And then come women clergy, then come male clergy, and at the bottom of the heap are women married to male clergy. So I do think I was treated differently because I was a wife. I think I had ways to say, I need to go home now. I have, someone to be with, someone to cook supper for, some place to go. I think I do not have children, so that was not part of the equation. But I do think I was treated differently in many different ways. You know, some people wondering if I were not controlled by my husband and his spokesperson, which was really laughable. But on the other hand, I think I was given some leeway to be a family person and a wife as well as a priest. So that was the happy side of that.
What do you think explains that the husbands of women priests rank really high on the satisfaction level and that the wives of male priests rank really low?
I think that has everything to do with expectation. No one in the world knows what to do or no one in the world knew what to do at first with men married to women clergy. My husband still receives invitations to tea parties for clergy spouses. And the first time he was invited to a clergy spouse retreat, he just had a great time wondering who his roommate would be. So there is a way in which I really chalk that up to the differences in expectations that women married to male clergy have, decades of expectations heaped on them about who they will be and what they will do, whereas men are relatively free from that. There's also a kind of cultural bias that the men have jobs that they're supposed to be at. They're supposed to be out being breadwinners, so there's not the same expectation that you get a two-for-one or that men married to women clergy will be fully involved in the life of a church.
What kind of work does your husband do?
He's a retired engineer who is now a organic vegetable farmer and stone carver, so he's having a wonderful time.
In the Episcopal Church, there's been quite a big and ongoing debate about the ordination of gay bishops, and in fact, this debate threatens to split apart the worldwide Anglican Church, of which the Episcopal Church is part. And at the church level, you probably didn't have to think much about the ordination of gay priests, but I'm sure the issue of gay members, openly gay members, a blessing of gay relationships did come up. How was that addressed at your church?
It was a live issue, and I think because I was one of the earlier women clergy, I have always thought now of the discussion, the debate, the upset around gay and lesbian clergy as being about sexuality as much as it is about homosexuality. And I think that the fears in many cases are the same. I've even had some friends who have become pregnant and who serve churches find that they stirred up quite a bit simply by being very pregnant at the communion rail or behind the altar. So I do register what is going on in the Anglican Communion, and not only there, but in many, many mainline churches in the United States, as being about sexuality. The fears at the local level were huge. I left before the consecration of the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, so that was not something that I dealt with at the parish level, but I did. I was required by the diocese, along with every parish priest in the diocese, to convene a group to talk about human sexuality. And the subtext was homosexuality. But I was very interested in that group to find out the broad range of unhappiness, of tension, of fear that people brought to that discussion. So I think we're acting that out nationally and internationally. At least one way I register that is its penance the church is paying for centuries of saying nothing about sexuality except don't.
So did this discussion of homosexuality lead to larger discussions of sexuality, you know, of just all kinds of human sexuality?
It did, although I think it's very human to wish to stay focused on a small group of people who happen not to be me or my people, and to call their sexuality up into the light of day to be examined for its holiness or its parallel with Scripture, and then to let everybody else off the hook. So that conversation did not remain as broad as I would like for it to have been. But another important thing that happened in that meeting is that several people said to the larger group, well, you may not know you're talking about me, but I am a gay person. I am a lesbian person. And it was remarkable what could happen at that point when the issue stopped being a, quote, issue and ended up being a person with a face and a life and a voice and a heart who could talk.
So how were those people who did come out accepted?
Loved. They were loved before, loved after. There may have been a jump back at one point while people rearranged their image of this person who was already a beloved person to them. But for the most part, I found that the old country rural rule held, and that was a version of whatever you do is your own business, just don't rub my nose in it.
Let me read something that you write in the book about this. You write, since I was responsible for the care of souls who did not share my conviction, I learned to feign neutrality as I presided over increasingly bitter debates about homosexuality. So why did you feel you had to feign neutrality?
When one is ordained, there is a lot of language about being shepherd of a flock. Even at the level of bishop in the Episcopal Church, a bishop walks down the aisle of a cathedral church with a great big shepherd staff. And what all of that language and imagery said to me and says to many of us who are ordained is that we are shepherds of the whole flock, that we are responsible for leading all to fresh water and good pasture, and not to those whose ideologies match ours or even those whose commitments or reading of Scripture match ours. So I felt responsible in that regard for not dividing the flock into sheep and goats. That's God's business, not mine. But it is one of the reliefs I experienced when I finally left parish ministry. The way the question began to form itself for me went like this. At what point does being a shepherd keep me from following the shepherd? That is, at what point does my trying to keep the whole flock together interfere with my ability to do and be what I believe God is calling me to do and be, especially in terms of the inclusion of all people in the church?
Barbara Brown Taylor is the author of the new book, Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. She teaches religion at Piedmont College and is a columnist and editor-at-large for The Christian Century. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg looks back on the days of Plutomania and considers the new definition of planet. And we continue our conversation with Episcopal priest Barbara Brown Taylor. She'll explain why she left active ministry to teach. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Barbara Brown Taylor. She was ordained as an Episcopal priest in 1983, served as an associate in a large urban church in Atlanta, then in 1992 became the first woman rector of Grace Cavalry Church in a small town in North Georgia. 5 years later, she left active ministry to accept an endowed chair in religion at Piedmont College. She says taking her collar off turned out to be as necessary to her salvation as putting it on. She's written a memoir called Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. You've given us some sense of the reasons why you resigned from parish ministry. But was there a last straw for you?
I think the last straw really came when, by all standards of success, the ministry at Grace Calvary had succeeded. We had doubled in membership. We had doubled in budget. We had doubled in terms of the number of people in worship on Sunday mornings to the point that we had gone from 2 services to 4. And it became very clear that in order even to have a wedding or a funeral that everyone could attend at the same time, we needed a larger space in which to meet. So like many other churches in other places, we began to talk about our physical space. And that caused such furor in this gorgeous little white clapboard chapel in the woods built in 1842, an absolute jewel of Victorian architecture. It caused such furor among parishioners. I think, again, fear got cranked up. What will happen if we become large? What happens to our intimacy with one another? What happens to our love of this small, beautiful space where we worship God? So the last straw for me was realizing that after about a year of engaging these conversations, I had no vision for how to move forward. I had no ability to help that congregation take that step. And in fact, if I did, I was looking at 2 to 3 years of capital funds campaigns and building programs and spending a lot of days bent over a blueprint and a hole in the ground. And I think that was the last straw.
It must be really hard to resign from a church the way you did. I mean, it's always, I think, hard to resign from a job, but you're resigning as, you know, you're resigning from parish ministry. So you could also feel like you're betraying the members of your congregation, and you could feel that you're betraying God because you plan to, at this point, leave the ministry altogether and teach instead. Can you describe some of the things that went through your mind and some of the things you had to wrestle with before feeling confident that you weren't doing a terrible thing by leaving?
Oh, well, you've just read my mind. Everything you just said went through my mind at that point. And in fact, I could not write this book for 5 years. The events in this book happened now 9 going on 10 years ago. So it took me 4 or 5 years even to be able to speak of what I had done as anything positive instead of only the kind of betrayals that you mentioned. Some people read the book and wonder what the big deal is about, because clearly I'm still a priest. I'm still active in churches across the country. But the big deal was the death of an identity, that I was and would forever be a parish priest who spent her life doing that work. The death of some faith in the institution of the church as a place in which transformation was happening. I lost some faith in that. I had some disillusionment around that. There was a great deal of grief and sense of betrayal in all of that. So the working out of this book was, in a way, telling a story I needed to hear, which was how someone who had left parish ministry after 20 years could, first of all, still be a priest, and second of all, still be engaged in lively work in the world. And I believe I found a way to say that all of those are so. One other thing I should mention is my predecessor at Grace Calvary had died in office, and the two before him had been ridden out of town. So at least one person thanked me afterwards. She thanked me for leaving in the regular way. She thought that was a great plus.
When you told the members of your church that you were leaving, did you say, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have compassion fatigue and I can no longer be your priest"?
I did not. I truly, in some ways, don't remember what I said. I even saved the letter so I could read it later. At that point, I was almost blind with anxiety about leaving this path that I thought would be my path for a much longer time than it was. So I believe I phrased it this way, that I could not see a way forward, that I had been offered a teaching job, that I am the daughter of a college teacher, had always dreamed of teaching college. I think I phrased it more in terms of wanting to do this new work that was being offered to me. So that was the public face of it. And the more private truth of it was that I was exhausted and that I found myself at a dead end.
Did you think, being a priest, that when you were exhausted, that somehow God should heal you, make you whole, revive your energy, and allow you to continue?
That's wonderful. Yes, I did. And I think that's a huge illusion, that somehow if I would work all the time, never complain, be a good person, be a terrific eldest child, be the world's best priest, that the energy would appear, that my plate would be full every day, that I would never run out of gas. And I think, looking back, that was like failing to take responsibility for the care of my own soul, that anyone who wants to remain in that vocation for a long time had better learn how to cook him or herself a meal, because the Holy One has a lot else to do. So certainly I did. I operated under that illusion for a long time. If I would just do my job well, I would never grow weary. My feet would never fail. I think there's even a scriptural passage like that. But in my case, it meant I fell flat on my face. So I learned to walk beside the still waters myself. I learned how to graze in some pastures. I learned how to be quiet, how to take time apart, and how to do for myself the same things I encouraged other people to do.
Okay, but wasn't there a voice in your head saying, but this is supposed to be a self-sacrificing position. This isn't about your well-being or your ability to enjoy solitude. This is about you helping the people in your church. So tough it out.
That's right. That's right. Give and give and give until there's nothing left to give. That's a central paradigm in the Christian tradition. Walk into any church, after all, and you're usually looking at a cross. And in that understanding, the way of life is the way of loving until it kills you. I had to work hard to find in my own tradition resources, both in Scripture and in the teachings of the tradition, that, well, for instance, pointed out how often Jesus said to his followers, let's go away for a little while to a quiet place and rest. The fact that when they got there, there were 5,000 hungry people waiting for them, somehow in my mind, X'd out his invitation to rest. And it took a long time for me to understand the invitation to rest still stands, regardless of how many hungry people there are. This never makes it easy. And in some ways, the huge discovery for me in the past 7 or 8 years has been that there is this distinct possibility that what God most wants from me is not the worn-out, empty sack of myself, but my full and whole humanity, granted, at the service of other people. But to be at the service of other people, you got to have something to serve. So it's taken a long time to win that wisdom.
My guest is Barbara Brown Taylor. Her new memoir is called Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbara Brown Taylor, and her new memoir, Leaving Church, is about her work as a priest in a small church in a small town in Georgia, and then her decision to resign as a parish minister and to instead teach religion at a college. Leaving the parish ministry meant that you dressed differently, and mm-hmm. people would look at you differently. As you said, it's a new identity, going from, you know, a priest in a church to teacher in a college. So what are some of the ways that you think perceptions of you changed from people who didn't know your previous life as, mm-hmm. you know, as a church priest?
Well, on the plus side, if you go to my closet now, you'll see much more than black, gray, and black and gray stripes. You'll see red and green and blue and lots of colors. So it was terrific fun for me to break out of really a uniform I chose for myself. I know clergy who wear Hawaiian, you know, luau clergy shirts, for Pete's sake. So there's a lot of variety there I never made use of. A downside, I'm now just, I look exactly like any other 54-year-old woman who hasn't bothered to dye her hair, so I get ignored as easily as anyone else who no longer has a clerical collar to pique their curiosity. I have, since I gave up the clerical collar, traveled with my husband, who's an artist, to some occasions where people sidle up to me and say, "So what do you do?" And it's been also a kind of demotion, which has been both welcome and puzzling as I've relearned my way in the world without my uniform. As I have said before, sometimes people see me and they have to shake their heads and try to remember why they know me or where they know me from without the uniform. But I have largely experienced it as a great liberation. I still wear the collar on Sundays, but during the week I travel incognito, and it means I can be part of much more colorful conversations than I used to before.
Yeah, well, now that strangers don't know that you're a priest because you're not wearing the collar, do they talk around differently around you?
They do. In fact, just last week I was out with three Roman Catholic friends, two of whom were priests and one of whom is a campus chaplain, and the person who was serving our table had no clue whom she was talking to, so she was treating us all quite sassily, and we just howled because no one back home in our parishes treats us that way. So I have found a wonderful and welcome kind of irreverence as I learn how people really talk when they don't think there's a minister around. It's really very interesting.
Why do you wear your collar on Sundays?
Well, I wear my collar on Sundays because I am a priest. I still am a priest in good standing in the Episcopal Church, and Sundays seem to me like a formal occasion. I would no more go to an evening wedding, you know, wearing a denim skirt than I would show up on Sunday without a clerical collar. That's the proper dress for that occasion. And it is a sign of my office, and it's an office that I have not left behind, even though I no longer exercise that office on a full-time basis in the parish. So
I want to ask you a larger question about the Episcopal Church. You know, as we discussed earlier, the larger Anglican Church is in danger of actually splitting apart over the issue of the ordination of gay bishops. Do you think that it's worth compromising on that to keep the church together? Or do you think if the church is so opposed to the spiritual lives of homosexuals that it's maybe worth leaving?
I'm first of all grateful I'm not the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church or even the bishop of a diocese. You spoke earlier about some of the occupational hazards of leadership, and at least one of those is needing to be attentive to the life of the whole community. And I do have a presiding bishop in the Episcopal Church who's attentive to that. At my very local level, now that I am no longer, you know, reflecting on a particular congregation of people, I am free to say that I find this a justice issue. And while I do not expect the ordination of gay and lesbian people or even the blessing of same-sex unions to be justice issues in every part of the world, they are where I live. And those two things concern not only people I love, but people through whom God is acting and speaking and moving in this world. And to, in any way, cut off that ministry, in any way, to dishonor that image of God in these people strikes me as, in religious language, a sin. I don't see any solution in the short term. But I have no hesitation in myself in saying where I stand on both of those.
And do you stand in favor of gay equality within the church at any cost, you know, at the cost of the church splitting apart?
I believe that, in fact, the church is both split and together. One of the reasons I chose the Episcopal Church in the first place was it was not a church that insisted on my doctrinal conformity. It was a book whose it was a church whose book was called the Book of Common Prayer and not the Book of Common Belief. So I think in many ways we are already so different that you could call us split. And in many ways we are still so alike, united chiefly through our prayers, that we are still together. Both are true. Both are true.
But the thing I'm really asking you is that, you know that some people are not willing to stay in the same church with gay priests or with people who want to ordain more gay bishops. I mean, with people who want to ordain more gay bishops. So there might be not a, there might be a more literal split. Would you?
Well, I think the Episcopal Church as a whole may have found a way to avoid that. But I'll be very direct. If there is something worth schism, this may be it. Mm-hmm. The Episcopal Church has always had a saying that heresy is not as bad as schism, that it's better to hang together with a lot of variety in belief than it is to split up so that we don't talk to each other anymore. But I am a Southerner, and I'm very mindful that the Episcopal Church did not split over slavery as some other denominations did. That would have been something worth splitting over. And this may be another. And a split would be a grave, grave sadness, big tragedy.
I thought I'd end with a light, simple question.
Let's do that.
Yeah, well, you've used the word God a lot during this interview, so my light, simple question is, when you say the word God, what does God mean to you? Like, what do you think when you use the word God? What are you thinking of?
When I use the word God, I am so aware I'm using a code word, and that everyone who hears that word, and probably everyone who uses it, imagines something different. Imagines a different posture in front of that being, that presence. I suppose my own image, my own idea of God, as imperfect and as evolving as it is right now, would be the glue that hooks everything together, the consciousness that moves between all living things. When I use the word God, I do not envision a large person with two arms, two legs, a nose, and two eyes. I envision instead some presence so beyond my being, a presence that both knows the stars by name and knows me by name as well, that is not here to be useful to me, that is not here to give me things as much as to ask me to give myself away for love. I, of course, get a great deal of what I mean by God from the tradition in which I stand, the Christian tradition, the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament. But when I say I believe in God, I mean I trust in the goodness of life, of being. I trust that beyond all reason. I trust that with my life, and that's what I mean by God.
And do you consider different religions, different expressions or interpretations of that same presence that you're describing?
I do, and I get in a lot of trouble for that. I teach world religions at Piedmont College, so I've had going on 9 years now to make friends in most of the major world traditions, to read pretty widely in them. And to become clear that none of us has a corner on absolute truth, which may well exist, but we are absolutely incapable of knowing it. And what we do have is one another. We have other human beings with hearts like ours, longings like ours, joys like ours. And that human-to-human level has reliably been the place where I experience the divine most directly. So that's the direction I'm still headed in.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed talking to you too.
Barbara Brown Taylor is the author of the new book, Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. She teaches religion at Piedmont College and is a columnist and editor-at-large for the Christian Century. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg looks back on the days of Pluto mania and considers the new definition of planet. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg doesn't profess to know much about astronomy, but when astronomers change the definition of the word planet, they enter Jeff's territory, language.
It isn't completely certain that Mickey Mouse's dog Pluto was named after the planet. Actually, Pluto was a fairly common name for dogs and horses in the early part of the 20th century. But Disney's bloodhound first appeared under the name Pluto in the cartoon The Moose Hunt in 1931, just a year after the announcement that Clyde Tombaugh of the Lowell Observatory in Arizona had discovered a new planet beyond the orbit of Neptune. And it's hard to believe that Disney wouldn't have tried to take advantage of the Plutomania that was sweeping the nation. After the announcement, thousands of people wrote in to suggest names for the planet. The popular story has it that the name Pluto was submitted by an 11-year-old British schoolgirl, though it was more likely devised by the Italian astronomers who corroborated the discovery. Meanwhile, Tombaugh himself was lionized as an American hero on the model of Charles Lindbergh, a 22-year-old aw shucks Kansas farm boy and self-taught astronomer who had beat the best scientist of the world in the search for the elusive Planet X that was thought to be perturbing the orbit of Neptune. And the public's imagination quickened even more when it was mistakenly announced that the new planet was the Earth's near twin in mass. As the papers put it, it was the only planet a human being could go without changing his weight. This had all happened before, of course. William Herschel's discovery of Uranus in 1781 so excited the world that from that moment on, the detection of a new planet epitomized the ecstasy of scientific discovery. The feeling that Keats famously captured in the lines from On First Looking into Chapman's Homer, "Then felt I like some watcher of the skies when a new planet swims into his ken." And the discovery of Neptune in 1846 provoked a similar popular sensation, along with a spirited controversy when the French and English both claimed credit for the first sighting. But after last week, it's not likely that any of that will ever happen again. The more restrictive definition of a planet that was adopted last Thursday at the meeting of the International Astronomical Union in Prague didn't simply demote Pluto from a planet to what's now called a dwarf planet. As several astronomers pointed out, it also made it extremely unlikely that any new objects will be found in the solar system that can qualify for the planet label. The new definition was chosen over one that would have kept Pluto a planet, but would also admit several other bodies to planethood, almost certainly with more in the offing. From here on in, the number of the planets is necessarily 8, what the astronomers now refer to as the classical planets, which is just another way of saying a planet that was known in the day of Jules Verne. Actually, both the winning and losing definitions of a planet had a decidedly legalistic cast to them. The astronomers were clearly less interested in carving nature at the joints than in finding plausible-sounding criteria that would give due honor to the cultural significance that people have always accorded the notion of a planet. In fact, the astronomers implicitly conceded that the winning definition was ad hoc when they stipulated that it would only apply to objects in our own solar system. That's like hearing biologists propose a definition of mammals that only holds for North America. It's a good example of what legal theorists disparage as result-oriented jurisprudence. You couldn't help being reminded of the Supreme Court's decision in Bush v. Gore, another result-oriented decision that was limited to the present circumstances, as the court put it, and which couldn't be cited as precedent in other cases. The only interesting question was why it was necessary for the astronomers to go through the whole business in the first place, and why anybody else should care. After all, language routinely recognizes natural categories that have no good scientific basis. There's no geological reason why we should consider Europe a separate continent from Asia, and no botanical reason why we should refer to tomatoes as vegetables rather than fruits. There's no way to define the lily that doesn't include a lot of tulips as well. And there are other words like shrub and weed that don't have any kind of scientific definition at all. So why can't we just keep using planet however we damn well please? But then, planet is a word that's been intimately connected with science since Herschel's day. You can be interested in lilies or tomatoes without caring much about botany, but being interested in planets pretty much guarantees you're a science buff. For generations, the very idea of other planets has given schoolchildren their first taste of the romance of science. And it was no doubt in the hope of preserving that romance that the astronomers decided to adopt a definition that closed off the club, rather than using one that included Pluto, but would also require them to acknowledge a new member every time some astronomer discovered a biggish ice ball in the far reaches of the Kuiper Belt. The irony is that nobody will ever again thrill to the news of a planetary discovery in our own solar system. Astronomers will continue to locate curious objects orbiting the Sun beyond the orbit of Neptune, and the discoveries will be given respectful mention in the science pages. But from here on in, none of them is going to have a cartoon character named after it.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book on political language is called Talking Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Half Broken Things, a novel of psychological suspense by Morag Yass, author of Fruitful Bodies. From the Ford Foundation, committed to creating opportunities for people to live freer, better, and more prosperous lives, online at fordfound.org. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at TIAACREF.org/greater good. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, on the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, we talk with Father Doug Dusan and Sister Kathleen Pittman, who are rebuilding their church in New Orleans. And we talk with Ivor Van Heerden, Deputy Director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.